a year. He was in Saudi Arabia, and we reported that based on his own aides and commanders, he couldn't get back to Yemen because the Emiratis didn't want him to return.
Maggie, we just have 30 seconds. And I just wanted to quickly ask, is the U.S. involved with giving lists of names of Yemenis to the Emiratis to jail?
The Americans have a list of most wanted men, but not every single man arrested by the Emiratis are on the list. The Emiratis are trying to get information about the men in the list through mass arrest.
Maggie Michaud, we want to thank you for being with us. We're going to link to your piece. Maggie is a reporter for Associated Press. Her latest piece, Detainees Held Without Charges Decry Emiratis Sexual Abuses. We'll also link to her last year's piece in Yemen's Secret Prisons, UAE Tortures, and U.S. Interrogates. That's all for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Sojourner Truth Radio is next, discussing the roots and legacy of Juneteenth, which commemorates the announcement of the abolition of slavery in Texas.
One nation, one cause, one people, one tribe. Now it's us against the pipeline. Get on your feet for Standing Rock, and we'll show you how strong we could be when we unify.
KBOO hosts beloved community and action movie nights every third Thursday at 7 p.m. here at the radio station. June 21st, we'll show the documentary film Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock. Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock captures the story of Native-led defiance that changed the fight for clean water, the environment, and the future of our planet. Again, that's a screening of Awake for the KBOO Beloved Community in Action Movie Night on Thursday, June 21st at 7 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The planet's been in decline since 1492, 500 years and counting, surviving the genocide they call colonizing my turtle island.
KBOO Community Radio cordially invites you to the Women of KBOO Celebration and Open House on Friday, June 29th from 7 to 10 p.m. It's here at the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Join us for the open house and an evening of on-air programming hosted by Barbara Bernstein and featuring Carol Major, Victoria Stapiello, and Maureen Key. We're celebrating the contribution of women volunteers, DJs, on-air hosts, staff, and board members in making KBOO what it is today. Light snacks and drinks will be provided. Everyone is welcome. Again, that's the Women of KBOO Celebration and Open House. It's on Friday, June 29th from 7 to 10 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Southeast Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Well, Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, speaking to you from the Pacifica Radio Studios in Washington, D.C., WPFW. Today, during our show, it is Juneteenth. We get the background of this commemorative day, known by Black communities across the United States, but little known in the wider community. Our guest is historian Dr. Gerald Horn. And rebel forces continue to be pounded by Saudi-led forces who are supported by the United States as the humanitarian crisis in Yemen deepens. Our guest is Yemeni independent journalist Shireen Al-Aldimi. And the Poor People's Campaign, launched on May 15th of this year, is in its final week of civil disobedience and other actions. A week of protests, civil disobedience, and cultural activities will be taking place in the nation's capital, culminating in a mass rally on Saturday, June 23rd. Thus far, over 2,000 protesters have been arrested in over 31 states, making it the largest civil disobedience protest in recent U.S. history, but it is getting ignored by mainstream media. What is the latest news from the Poor People's Campaign? And as the campaign gears up for its long-term strategy, this is just the beginning, what has been its impact thus far? Our guests are Washington, D.C.-based the Reverend William Lamar IV, pastor of Metropolitan African Methodist Episcopal Church, and the Reverend Eddie Anderson, one of the California co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. President Donald Trump plans to meet with congressional Republicans to discuss immigration legislation. This afternoon's meeting will come as pressure mounts on the Trump administration to reverse its policy of separating undocumented immigrant children from their parents. Smuggled audio from a detention center of children sobbing for their mothers and fathers dramatized the trauma.
No, Papa.
Trump remained defiant yesterday as he blamed Democrats while defending the administration's policy.
The United States will not be a migrant camp, and it will not be a refugee holding facility. Won't be. You look at what's happening in Europe, you look at what's happening in other places, we can't allow that to happen to the United States, not on my watch.
Under the new policy adopted by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, all unauthorized border crossings are referred for prosecution. That process moves adults to the custody of the U.S. Marshals Service and sends many children to facilities run by the Department of Health and Human Services. Under the previous administration, such families usually were referred for civil deportation proceedings, not requiring separation. Nearly 2,000 children were separated from their families over a six-week period in April and May. Figures for June are not yet available. Michigan Republican Representative Fred Upton called for an immediate end to what he called the ugly and inhumane practice of family separation. Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski called on the White House to end what she called the cruel, tragic separation of families. State lawmakers weighed in, including Republican Assemblyman Rocky Chavez, representing parts of San Diego. He accused Republicans in Washington of using the family separation policy to try to force action on immigration reform that includes an expanded border wall.
We should not be leveraging one of the core components of our society, and that's the family, and separate them for a political solution. As a Republican, a proud Republican, what we're doing right now is wrong.
The Republican governor of Massachusetts has canceled the deployment of his state's National Guard troops to the border to protest the Trump administration family separation policy. Governor Charlie Baker spoke to reporters about his decision.
Well, we said 2 weeks ago that I did not support the decision of the Trump administration to separate kids from their families. And I think it's cruel and inhumane. And we told the National Guard to hold steady and to not go down to the border, period.
The Boston Globe reports that Massachusetts had agreed in recent weeks to deploy a helicopter and two military analysts to the border, where they would operate with members of the Arizona and New Mexico National Guard. But for now, that decision is canceled. Donald Trump has directed the U.S. Trade Representative to prepare new tariffs on $200 billion in Chinese imports as the two nations move closer to an all-out trade war. The tariffs, which Trump once set at a 10% rate, would be the latest round of punitive measures in an escalating dispute over the large trade imbalance between the two countries. Trump recently ordered tariffs on $50 billion in Chinese goods in retaliation for what he claimed was intellectual property theft. The tariffs were quickly matched by China on U.S. exports, a move that drew Trump's response. China's Commerce Ministry criticized the latest threat of tariffs and warned that if, quote, the U.S. becomes irrational and issues this list, China will have no choice but to adopt strong countermeasures of the same amount and quality. Almost 2.5 million homes will be at risk of climate change-related flooding in the next 30 years. That's according to a new report by the Union of Concerned Scientists. Christopher Martinez reports.
The continental United States, the lower 48, has 1,300 miles of coastline. That's often prime property. Think ocean view homes, beachfront businesses, and vacation communities. But sea level rise caused by climate change is putting those properties at risk. A new report by the Union of Concerned Scientists says by the end of the century, nearly 2.5 million properties will be at risk of chronic flooding. Christina Dahl is a senior climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists.
What we see is that sea level rise presents a very near-term problem to coastal real estate. So by 2045, we see over 100,000 homes at risk of this chronic flooding. And by the end of the century, with a high sea level rise scenario, we see 2.5 million homes and businesses at risk. Today, those homes and businesses are worth a collective $1 trillion.
New York, New Jersey, and Florida are especially vulnerable. I'm Christopher Martinez.
I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Today is Juneteenth. Now, a lot of people in Black communities across the United States would know exactly what that is, but for whiter communities, people are very unfamiliar with Juneteenth. While we're waiting for Dr. Gerald Horn, I'd like to remind our audience that he is the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's published more than 30 books, including Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, as well as Paul Robeson, the Artist as Revolutionary. Now, June 19th, one would not be surprised to learn that in some Black communities in the United States, families may be gathering, there may be picnics being planned, people may be finding a way perhaps they're working for a company or a boss that kindheartedly had said, okay, you can have the day off, but today is Juneteenth, and a number of Juneteenth celebrations happened actually this past weekend. Some of them are going to be happening this coming weekend, but Juneteenth commemorates the announcement of the abolition of slavery in Texas. 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, the news finally reached Texas. On June 19, 1865, the abolition of slavery was announced in the U.S. state of Texas, and more generally, the emancipation of enslaved African Americans throughout the former Confederacy, the southern states, of the United States. Now, looking at politics today, a number of analysts are saying, and just the reality that people are facing, are saying, well, it seems as though the Civil War never really ended. Nevertheless, Juneteenth is recognized as a state holiday or a special day of observance in 45 states. People across the country are celebrating Juneteenth by they're doing a number of things, public readings of the Emancipation Proclamation, singing traditional songs, some of which came out of the black church, such as Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, the reading of literary works by well-known African-American writers, Maya Angelou, Ralph Ellison, and others. Let me see if I do have Dr. Horn on the line now. Dr. Horn, can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay, very good, Dr. Horn. While we were waiting to get you on, I gave at least a little of the background of Juneteenth. But, Dr. Horn, let's start with you first telling us what the heck happened that it took 2 years before Texas and other Confederate states in the Confederacy knew that those enslaved were supposed to be free. Dr. Gerald Horn.
Well, keep in mind that when President Abraham Lincoln issued his so-called Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863, it basically applied in jurisdictions over which he had no control. And those jurisdictions included Texas, South Carolina, Mississippi, Virginia, the rest of the so-called Confederate States of America. And so when the Civil War ended in early April 1865, there was this plan, to put it mildly, by some slave owners to continue slavery forevermore. And it took the arrival of Union troops in Texas on June 19, 1865, to lay down the law and declare that slavery was abolished in Texas. Now, first of all, a little background. By 1860, Texas had over 250,000 enslaved Africans at its disposal. This was out of a total of 4 million in the continental United States of America. But that figure in some ways underestimates Texas's role in slavery. Texas was the only state in the so-called Confederate States of America that had been an independent nation between 1836 and 1845. Keep in mind that Texas had seceded from Mexico in 1836 precisely because Mexico had sought to abolish slavery under a president of African descent, speaking of Vicente Guerrero.
And Dr. Horn, just pause there. I mean, for those who are confused about why we need black and brown unity, right, particularly our brown brothers and sisters coming from across the border who are suffering so terribly now with their children being snatched from them, a government, the Trump administration, basically doing child abuse, we have to remember the principal position that Mexico took against slavery. I just wanted to underscore that, Dr. Horn.
Well, not only that, but as is well known, when enslaved Africans fled to freedom, they were not only following the North Star to Canada, they were also heading south, particularly from Texas into Mexico, where they were then greeted warmly. I should also say that one of the other reasons why slavery in Texas was so stringent and so violent was because the original inhabitants of that land, the people we refer to as the Comanches, were probably some of the fiercest fighters that the U.S. government ever had to contend with, and they too welcomed enslaved Africans. I should also say that there were major wars that took place in Florida that involved a joint force of people we refer to as Seminoles and Africans. And after they were defeated, they fled en masse to Mexico, and they too helped to welcome enslaved Africans who were fleeing from slavery in Texas. But to get back to my prior point, when Texas was an independent state, it was a slave-owning state. It was a slave-trading state. That is to say that a goodly number of the Africans in Cuba came across the Atlantic on boats that bore the Lone Star flag of Texas. The same holds true for Brazil. the Lone Star flag of independent Texas could be found off the coast of West Africa, particularly Congo. And in fact, as late as 1860, you had hundreds of Congolese smuggled into Galveston, Texas. And so because of this very violent background, it's no accident that the slave owners in Texas thought that they perhaps could continue slavery forevermore, despite the fact that the Confederate States of America had just lost the Civil War.
Yeah, so likely no accident, right? that they allegedly got the news 2 years later. Dr. Horn.
Well, absolutely. And keep in mind as well that a goodly number of the African-American population now in Southern California has roots in Texas. Recall that Barry White, the composer and singer, he hailed from Galveston and was part of that Texas, descended from that Texas enslaved population. Jack Johnson, the heavyweight boxing champion, who President Trump has just issued a posthumous pardon, hailed from Galveston, Texas. And so Texas has played a pivotal role, not only in the history of slavery and fighting slavery, but also, I should say, in the history of resisting slavery. Because one of the other reasons why Texas slaveholders were so reluctant to relinquish their hold upon their enslaved population was because their enslaved population oftentimes retaliated bloodily against the slave owners. There was a phenomenon known as the Texas Terror in the early 1860s. It was only a terror to the slave owners because during a mass uprising of the enslaved population, probably assisted by Mexico, the Comanche population, and perhaps the Seminole African population that had migrated from Florida to the Texas-Mexico border in the middle part of the 1850s.
Right, and as you say, I mean, the Emancipation Proclamation had declared that all enslaved persons in the Confederate States of America in rebellion and not in Union possession were to be freed, and that excluded five states known later as border states, which were the four slave states not allegedly in rebellion: Kentucky, Maryland, Delaware, Missouri, and Texas. But interestingly enough, speaking of the resistance in Texas, in 1980, Texas was the first state to mark Juneteenth as a state holiday under legislation introduced by Democratic State Representative Al Edwards. But Dr. Horn, now we do have to fast forward a bit because Juneteenth has very deep significance to a number of us. I mean, not only what happened back of the in the day, but looking at the challenges that we're facing now, we see, well, it's obvious what's going on. A number of people still fighting, it seems, the Civil War. You have campuses like Ole Miss, which was desegregated at great cost, still today having a lot of racial tensions and struggles, particularly around buildings that are named after white supremacists, the statues representing the Confederacy, but also what a number of people are calling the modern-day lynchings of the killings of young black people, where a lot of black youth are feeling. I spoke to one the other day who said, every time I go out the door, I feel like there is a target on my back. But Dr. Horn, before we leave this topic, you know, just please tie into us that history of what happened, but also of resistance and the challenges facing, I have to say, not only the black community, it's facing the black community, but these are issues facing the entire United States that some way, somehow have to be grappled with. Dr. Gerald Horn.
Well, point number one is that when slavery was finally abolished, you had one of the largest uncompensated expropriations of private property in the history of the world up to that point. In other words, we oftentimes talk about reparations, that is to say reparations for the unpaid labor of the descendants of enslaved Africans, but the slave owners felt that they should have been compensated, like the slave owners in Haiti were compensated after slavery was abolished, like the slave owners in the Caribbean Barbados, Jamaica, et cetera, were compensated. And one of the major reasons for the continuing fury and anger of Dixie has to do with the fact that you have many white families were plunged into poverty because their major source of income, their enslaved Africans, were taken from them, and they're still angry and furious about that, which is one of the reasons why Dixie, and particularly Texas, is the heart of conservatism. We should also point out the fact that with the arrival on the scene of Donald Trump, you now see him seeking to spread his right-wing populist message globally. His ambassador in Germany just announced that he's going to try to help to empower like-minded right-wing populists, neo-fascists, throughout Europe, Germany, Hungary, Poland in particular. And so it's fair to say that this question of Juneteenth and slavery is not just a U.S. issue, it has also become a global issue of consequence.
Right. Well, on that note, Dr. Gerald Horn, again, thank you so much for breaking this down for us. And we're looking forward to you participating in our weekly roundtable, which will be happening from our studios, WPFW in Washington, D.C. Dr. Gerald Horn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are now going to turn our attention to Yemen. For those of you who are not aware of what's going on in Yemen, thousands of people have died as a result of airstrikes and cholera outbreaks. Of course, these are airstrikes led by a coalition of Saudi Arabia. And France is also involved. And, of course, the U.S., basically backing that incursion, those bombardments. And this is against a rebel group that has been fighting there. Now, cholera, famine, and displacement in Yemen are a direct result of Saudi-led airstrikes, according to major humanitarian organizations like Doctors Without Borders and Human Rights Watch. Now, the United States is one of several Western powers supporting the Saudis' war against the most impoverished nation on the Arabian Peninsula. The last June, United States I just refer to him as Donald Trump. Last June, Donald Trump signed a $110 billion deal selling weapons to Saudi Arabia during his first foreign visit as head of state. And last October, the UK, they got into the act. The UK Department for International Trade found that British sales of military equipment to Saudi Arabia topped $1 billion in the first half of 2017 alone. Now, Saudi Arabia and its Western allies began launching, and I'll have to say that not only its Western allies, but also allies within the region, began launching airstrikes in Yemen in 2015 following the removal of former President Mansour Hadi, an ally of Saudi Arabia. He was, but the population rose up against him. He was removed. The Ansar Allah movement, most commonly known as the Houthis, removed him from power. Now, opponents of the Houthis, they're claiming that the Houthis are simply proxies of Iran. We have to put all of this within the context of the conflict and the for hegemony, for power in the region between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And, of course, meanwhile, the Houthis claim that Hadi and the Yemeni government are simply puppets of Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia, mainly Sunni, and Iran, mainly Shia. But we know that this is not really a religious conflict. Like a lot of these conflicts, it has to do with power, with sometimes and often race, oil, resources, money, but also often proxy wars with Western governments like the United States right in the mix. Now, there is some recent news happening where the suffering is even increasing in Saudi Arabia, in Yemen. And to discuss all of that with us, because there's a fight going on now for an airport and a major port in Saudi Arabia, more bombs are raining down on innocent civilians. And I'd like to welcome Shireen Al-Adimi. She is from Yemen, and she has studied, did her doctorate at Harvard University, and she will be beginning her as assistant professor in education at Michigan State University in August. Now, since the Civil War broke out in March of 2015, Shireen has been voicing her opinions about what is going on. Shireen Al-Adimi, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Right. And Shireen, what can you tell us, just in terms of the introduction, which you likely heard, is there anything background-wise you would like to add to it? I should say that the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Kuwait, Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, Senegal, Sudan, the United States, United Kingdom, the UK, Australia, Turkey, Canada, South Korea, and France. That's a lot of power up against the rebels, the so-named rebels in Yemen. What is happening now?
Sure. Right. That is a lot of power. It's a lot of regional and international power. And unfortunately, the conflict gets discussed as a proxy war when there's actually very little evidence that Iranians have any significant influence on the Houthis. And, you know, the Houthis are absolutely not proxies of Iran. People in Yemen, whether they are Shia, Sunni, or, you know, belong to various other parties, most of them are very much opposed to this foreign intervention on their country. Yeah. Whether or not they support Houthis is a completely different story.
So, yeah, it's not like the Houthis, the people of Yemen, can't organize among themselves, right, to say we want to take action against a government we don't agree with.
Absolutely. So this is what's made this worse. You know, this began as a civil war with the Houthi takeover of Sana'a, the capital, to try to exert pressure on then-President Hadi, whose term had expired. And then, you know, he ended up actually resigning as the interim president, and fled to Saudi Arabia, and they began bombing. So, sorry?
Yeah, carry on.
Yeah, so he's very much viewed in Yemen as a puppet. He's not even based in Yemen. So the so-called legitimate president of Yemen is operating from hotels in Riyadh or in the UAE. So what's happening in Yemen is that people are trying to protect themselves from this international barrage of actors, while at the same time trying to figure out all these civil conflicts that have been going on for a while.
Right. Now, in terms of what is happening now with the bombardment of this port that is really the main point of entry, it is reported, for food and medicine in Yemen, a country that's already experiencing mass famine, mass disease. I mean, the suffering of the children, in particular, older people, women, just unconscionable. Tell us about the significance of that port and of, therefore, the fight for control of that port going on right now?
So the port of Hodeida is on the Red Sea, and those waters are controlled by Saudi Arabia and its coalition of allies. They've been blockading food, they have blockaded medicine, and, you know, the blockade so far has caused the death of 113,000 children who died due to malnutrition and disease just in the years 2016 and 2017, and this is according to the UN and Save the Children. So we know that children have already been dying, you know, in masses, and now they've attacked the port that supplies 80% of the population with food. And, you know, this is, I think, an indication that they're openly now using starvation as a weapon, because Hodeida was supposed to be the one red line. Hodeida was supposed to be the one place that they do not attack, because it will cause millions of people to starve. Yet they've shown extreme callousness and extreme disregard for human life. And I should add that the U.S., after warning the Emiratis not to leave this fight on Hodeida, have in fact been providing them with airstrike targets since this offensive began last week.
Yeah, you know, Shireen, You know, to hear about 113,000 children, I mean, we know that war in any form is a horror. You know, Pacifica yeah. Radio, we're for peace. We're totally, you know, against war. But, you know, so many people right now in the United States are beginning to grasp U.S. policy in relation to children at the border. Just the act, not just, I mean, the horrific act, child abuse act of separating mothers from their children, okay? Heartbreaking. I'm a mother. It breaks your heart to watch. But what a lot of people don't realize is that the tax dollars of people living in the United States right now are going to support a regime and a coalition causing not just the separation of children and from their mothers, but the deaths of 113,000 children, but also the three-quarters of the entire population could be at risk of losing access to necessary food and medicine that they receive through this Port Hedera. So that is child abuse. That's also embedded, you know, in this policy of supporting the Saudi efforts in bombarding Yemen, and then the U.S. population knowing very little about what's going on. Shireen.
Yeah, I think, you know, this week is a prime example of what happens when American citizens and residents are made aware of the really injustices and cruelty that some of these things that have been committed against other people and other people's children, you know. But I think the problem in Yemen is that just people don't know about it. You know, we have shows like yours that have been covering the conflict, but mainstream organizations have not covered the conflict. And when they do not include, you know, an explanation of the U.S.'s role in creating the famine. This is, it's construed as a conflict that's happening somewhere far away to other people, and we're somehow just bystanders. You know, in all of 2017, MSNBC had exactly one report, and they used the word, you know, America standing by as their allies, they're committing these atrocities. No, we are committing these atrocities along with our allies in the region. And I think if more people find out about what's happening, hopefully they will, you know, stand up for these children who are dying because, you know, again, for no reason at all.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of people, we are going to have to wrap this up, but we'll have you back because it's really important to get the news of what's going on in Yemen out there. You know, they assume, well, it's an ally, the United States, Saudi Arabia, a lot of problems in and of its own, especially, but not only in relation to how women are treated in Saudi Arabia, but a huge ally of the United States. The Saudi Arabia is the United States' largest foreign military sales customer with over 114 billion in active cases. Well, I'm not sure. I don't know how that contrasts with military support and aid for Israel from the United States. But you know, France is also involved. The Canadian government is also involved. But so people just can't sit on their hands and assume, well, the Houthis, they did something to deserve this kind of punishment. Just final thoughts from you.
Yeah, I Shireen. Think it's counter. You know, it doesn't serve U.S. interests to help the Saudis in any way. I just have to add that the Saudis, there's been documented evidence of cooperation between the Saudi-led coalition and Al-Qaeda militants against Houthis in Yemen. So we're not only supplying weapons, we're also refueling their airplanes, we're providing assistance with targeting, we are training their soldiers and so on. But these are the same people who are enabling and working with terrorists abroad. So it makes absolutely no sense to continue this partnership.
Yeah, and cholera spreading over 100,000 people, 462.
Over a million people.
Over a million people. Oh, my God. Over a million yeah. people. 16.4 million people lacking access to basic health care. 17 million people considered food insecure. 6.8 million severely food insecure. I mean, even the head of the UN said that what's happening in Yemen is one of the worst humanitarian disasters facing the planet right now. Would you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. There are people, you know, there are entire cities that have run out of fuel. You know, the reason cholera is an epidemic and it's the worst of its kind in modern human history is because people don't have access to clean water. And, you know, just, you know, 90% of the population has been living without electricity for the last 3 years. And so, you know, when we think about 80% of the population is in need of some sort of humanitarian aid just to survive, it, I think, you know, catalyzes how destructive this conflict has been.
Right, and even as Black communities across the nation mark Juneteenth today, we also will not forget our sisters and brothers who are suffering, who happen to be dark-skinned people as well, but that's not the point there. Our brothers and sisters who are suffering in other parts of the globe, and we'll certainly lift them up as we mark Juneteenth in the United States. Shireen El Adimi, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth from our station, our sister station in Washington, D.C., WPFW. And we are going to take a very short station break. And when we return, the Poor People's Campaign, what is known as the new Poor People's Campaign, a lot of activity going on in Washington, D.C. this week, which is part of why the Sojourner Truth team is here in Washington. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
When the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure.
Hands to the heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground. The camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Of course, that on this Juneteenth, that is the song Glory from the film Selma. And you just heard Common and John Legend. For those of you who've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety. And you could also check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you are a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook, follow all of news and views on Facebook, and also on our website, where we also carry a community calendar. And we're also on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And we would like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners. And today we'd like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners in that great capital city of Washington, D.C. We are now going to turn our attention to the Poor People's Campaign. I think we do have a clip ready that we'll play in just a moment, but no, we don't. Okay. But we do have some guests for you. But just to update you, of course, the Poor People's Campaign began, was called for back in 1968 by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King before he was assassinated. So he personally never lived to bring it into fruition. And I really think that he, the forces that be considered him increasingly dangerous as he not only came out against the war, the Vietnam War in particular, but he also brought in the whole issues of economic justice. So it was anti-racist, anti-war, but also pro-living wages for people. He even came out and called for a general strike in the city of Montgomery, in the city of Memphis, Tennessee, where he was there supporting low-wage workers, sanitation workers, when he was assassinated. A very sad day indeed. But on the anniversary of his assassination, the Reverend William Barber, who is, along with the Reverend Liz Theo Harris, joint coordinators of the Poor People's Campaign, they were on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, and Dr. Barber gave a very, very moving speech at that time, and you likely will be able to find that speech on YouTube or on various websites. Now, we are in Washington, D.C., myself and our new assistant producer, Romero Funes, and with the kindness of the team from WPFW, we're here because this is the final week of civil disobedience and protests happening, called by the Poor People's Campaign, that began on May 15th of this year. So a lot of people are saying, well, does it mean the Poor People's Campaign is over? No. This 6 weeks of action, that was just the launch. That was just the beginning of the Poor People's Campaign, that they see really as something long-term, given the goals that they're trying to achieve. And I'd like to have to say that right now, I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but as of last week, over 2,000 people, you hear me? 2,000 people were arrested doing civil disobedience across the United States in over 31 states, including red states, blue states, okay? A fusion coalition across race and across movements around what they call the four pillars of evil, which are racism, poverty, militarism, and environmental degradation. So people from Appalachia to, you know, California, people went to their state capitals, but also here in Washington, D.C. to protest. So what I'd like to do now is to just go on and welcome our guests. I'd like to welcome the Reverend William Lamar, who is the pastor of Metropolitan African Methodist Episcopal Church in Washington, D.C. Reverend Lamar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be with you.
And do we have the Reverend Eddie Anderson, one of the California co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign, on the line? Reverend Eddie, welcome back. Okay. Reverend Lamar, let's start with you, because you were one of the people arrested, was this last week? And I understand that Reverend Barber and a number of reverends, pastors, were not only arrested, but were shackled. Tell us what was going on. But also, now it seems that some members of Congress met with some people from the Poor People's Campaign and heard testimony. So at least that's a step in the right direction. But tell us about that experience and about your reaction to members of Congress beginning to listen to the message.
Sure. Again, thank you for allowing us to be with you today. On last Monday, a group of us were arrested, as has been the case for the past 4 to 5 weeks. Normally, when we protest on the grounds of the United States Capitol, the U.S. Capitol Police book us and release us, and we pay $50 fines. Nine of us on last Monday escalated the protest, and we walked to the Supreme Court up on the plaza so that we might pray together. Black, white, Christian, Jewish, persons of no particular faith, there were nine of us. Included in that nine is the Reverend Liz Theo Harris, the national co-chair. We were arrested by the United States Supreme Court police. We were shackled. We were taken downstairs to be held at the United States Supreme Court. We were held from about 4 or 5 o'clock until 10:30. We were transported to Central Cell Block in Washington, D.C., a roach-infested, intolerable place, unfit for human habitation. We were there until about 6 or 7 p.m., a.m., pardon me. Then we were transported to the U.S., to the D.C. Superior Court, and finally arraigned at the Federal District Court, released at about 7 p.m. So we were in custody of 26, 27, 30 hours. We were shackled. We were treated fairly well by those who were guarding us. Again, those are the working people for whom we're fighting. So it was an interesting, very interesting situation. We actually woke up the next morning when we were transported to Central City Cell Block. We were in a room holding cell with about 50 other people, the overwhelming majority black men. There were three white men, and two Latinos. Everyone else, young black men, by and large. And it was a despicable display of society discarding human beings, not really giving thought to rehabilitation, but really it's a display of American excess, how certain human beings are disposable and are treated in ways that did not resonate with people being made in the image and likeness of God. So it was for the nine of us. There were nine of us who did that because, of course, there are nine Supreme Court justices. And our thought was that if religious freedom as interpreted by the Supreme Court means that certain folks don't have to make cakes for gay persons getting married, if that's religious liberty, then we ought to be able to come to the highest court of the land and to pray for a jurisprudence that is just and not motivated by the biggest demons of right-wing demagoguery and white demographic anxiety.
Right. And Reverend Eddie Anderson, I mean, we'll come back to you, Reverend William Lemurs. A lot of activity going on in Washington, D.C. But Reverend Eddie Anderson, I understand, I think you were in the state capital of California yesterday. Can you tell us how that went? And something interesting happened in relation to some legislators in California. Reverend Eddie Anderson.
Absolutely, Margaret. Thank you so much for being on. So yesterday, we did three simultaneous waves of civil disobedience. We occupied the Senate gallery, as well as the Assembly gallery, and as well as the governor's office. We had 51 arrests yesterday, but one of the most surprising things that happened yesterday was that nine Assembly members from the state of California decided to go on a 50-hour fast in solidarity with the campaign.
Wow.
And we took over the assembly and began to protest and drop banners, read a civil complaint against the state of California. The entire assembly stopped what they were doing before they went on recess and gave the campaign a standing ovation.
Well, that is quite something, because, you know, there's so much talk about, well, what impact can a campaign like this have? I personally happen to think it's one of the most important movements that we have seen in quite some time in the United States. I don't know that there has been anything like it in terms of simultaneous actions happening across so many states and building that kind of fusion coalition. So, Reverend William Lemur, when you hear Reverend Eddie, as he is fondly known, those of us who know him in California, talk about, on the one hand, 51, did you say 51 arrests, Reverend Eddie?
51 arrests.
Wow, 51 arrests in Sacramento just yesterday, but also the legislators giving the protesters a standing ovation, and then nine of them saying, we're going to fast for 50 hours in solidarity with you. Reverend William Lemur IV, your response to that, and anything you can tell us about the response of people in Congress, legislators on Capitol Hill, to the Poor People's Campaign.
I want to applaud Reverend Eddie and to say the idea undergirding the campaign is that there must be action, not just in Washington, but in the state capitals around the nation. And also, after the launch of the campaign has sunset, we're looking for local people and local organizations to keep pushing forward the ideas of the campaign. What we are really excited about is that this campaign is not built around one personality or around one group, but it is a dispersed campaign, a fusion campaign. What I want to mention concerning the legislators who heard testimony from those with whom we are in solidarity around the conditions of poor people in the United States, the lack of living wages, the fact that 60% of black people live in poverty, 65% of Latinx people live in poverty. They did listen, but I have not heard the kind of solidarity that Reverend Eddie mentioned in Sacramento. I think one of the things that we need to really pay attention to is how money influences our legislators on the left and the right, and how halting both Democrats and Republicans have been to do what is necessary to care for the least among us. One of the things we want to do in the campaign is to eradicate the vicious lie that there is scarcity in America. There is not scarcity. There's an abundance. There is a lack of will to take care of certain kinds of human beings and what they need for human flourishing. One of the things the campaign continues to say is 53 cents of every tax dollar is spent in the war economy. That money can be used to build our communities. That money can be used to transform the lives of men and women in the United States of America. That's what we're fighting for, and I'm very proud of the work that Reverend Eddie and others are doing in California and around the nation.
Right, and back to you, Reverend Eddie Anderson. I mean, a lot of activity happening this week. Today in Washington, D.C., there's artwork going on all day, and this evening, Truthful Tuesdays. Tomorrow, Wednesday, there will be training happening in the morning, I think, canvassing happening, community canvassing happening on Thursday. There will be more direct action training, direct action happening. We don't know yet what the target or targets will be. And then on Friday, there will be workshops on a number of topics happening all day. And then that culminates with a mass rally and a march happening on Saturday, the 23rd. Any of our listeners can go to the Poor People's Campaign website and get information about any of those activities. And just yesterday in Washington, D.C., there were a number of places targeted for civil disobedience, but apparently there were no arrests in Washington, D.C., because the Capitol Police decided that they just were not going to do it. But a number of very creative actions happening. And even as we speak, ambassadors representing more than 30 states, ambassadors representing the Poor People's Campaign, people who are impacted by poverty, are on their way right now to Washington, D.C. Reverend Eddie Anderson, just in a couple of minutes, it's not easy building a fusion coalition. And there are some people, you know, perhaps who criticize the campaign and say, well, you know, there are not enough black folks involved or not enough brown folks involved. And what do you say? And I'll give you, Reverend William Lamar, a chance also to give a final thought to people who are listening about the importance of this. Can we really afford to sit on our hands and wait to be invited to the table? Reverend Andy, Eddie Anderson.
Thanks, Margaret. I look forward to seeing you in D.C. this week as well. But to your question, I think we cannot afford to be neutral. We see that children are being separated from their parents, like we saw with slavery, like we saw with the Native Americans, we saw with the Japanese Americans in internment camps. We can't afford to allow the violence of silence to take over our lives. So yesterday, when we left the Capitol, I reminded the group of symbols there that the days ahead may be darker, but each and every one of us are the bearers of the light.
Yeah.
And that the arc of justice only bends towards justice if we bend it. We have to go back to our communities, go back to our towns, continue to outreach, continue to share the message, and continue to bear the light until we to revive our morals and to lift up our highest good. And together we can be a future coalition. It will be hard, but I think it's possible.
Right, Reverend William Lamar, totally unfair, about 30 seconds for a quick final word.
I think that we must find collaboration among those who love justice and among those who have a vision that human beings should be treated equitably in this nation. And it is for us to wake up those who are asleep, and that's the work that we're committed to.
All righty, and thank you so very much. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. More coverage on the Poor People's Campaign coming up on Sojourner Truth tomorrow. I'd like to thank all of today's guests. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd really like to give a special thanks and props to Jerry Paris, who is the general manager at WPFW. Of course, our assistant producer, Romero Funes, and back on the boards at KPFK, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson, and all who helped to make this show possible. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow live from Washington, D.C. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Good morning, it's 8:59. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up in just about 1 minute, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Per Fogering welcomes Professor Michael T. Clare to talk about his latest article in Truth Out. That article is entitled Girding for Confrontation, the Pentagon's Provocative Encirclement of China. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman talks to writer, artist, and journalist Molly Crabapple about co-writing the new book, Brothers of the Gun, a memoir of the Syrian war. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. Keep informed and get involved by going to kboo.fm. And click on donate to become a member. It's 9 o'clock.
All I know, I keep making this fooler. I stay protected. That blue steel it do ya. Yeah, my chick bad and I keep the Kill Bill. Yeah, born and raised. Thoroughbred trio. Let's go, let's go. All I
know, hey, this is Randy West coming from OSP at our annual Yehusasa Talent Show.
Yeah, let me be clear about it. I got it. You way out of pocket. Go bring this shit here. Getting body back, tipping the bottle back.
Yeah, this your boy TJ down in OSP, man. I'm telling you, rap music, you know what I'm saying, R&B, you know what I'm saying, got a little bit of comedy up in there, man.
Y'all make sure y'all tune in June 25th at 6:30 p.m. Check out some of these guys from the OSP prison doing their thing, you know. We got a lot of acts and a lot of talent in here to share with the world, so just make sure y'all check that out. June 25th, 6:30 p.m., Prison Pipeline, y'all.
Tell me, baby, are we gonna let the elevator bring us down? Oh, no, let's go.